Hey, everybody, welcome back to Locked On Orioles, your place for news and analysis from the clubhouse to the warehouse and beyond. It's all O's all the time. As always, I'm your host, Justin McGuire. I'm a veteran baseball journalist who spent 8 years as a senior editor at Sporting News. I host another podcast called Baseball by the Book, which I would really appreciate if you'd check out. And I'm also a longtime Orioles fan since the 1970s. Today, we're joined by ESPN baseball analyst Dan Zimborski. He's here to talk about the ESPN Future Power Rankings, which came out this week. And, spoiler alert, the Orioles don't do too well. We'll get to that in just a second. First, I just want to remind everybody that we are now available on Apple Podcasts, so please go, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. Anything you can do like that will help us increase our visibility and increase our audience on Apple Podcasts. Also, you can find us at LockedOnOrioles.com. Also, I wanted to let you know, if you're interested in sponsoring Locked On Orioles, please contact me at LockedOnOrioles@gmail.com. Or, if you want to, there's opportunities to advertise with the entire Locked On MLB network, which includes individual podcasts for every team. Again, just email me at LockedOnOrioles@gmail.com. Okay, let's get on to our interview with Dan Zimborski. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles, everybody. We're joined now by Dan Zimborski. He's an ESPN baseball analyst. Dan, I wanted to talk to you about this thing that just came out this week that you wrote with Keith Law and Buster Olney, the ESPN Future Power Rankings, where you look at all 30 teams, kind of what their how bright their future looks, or how, in the case of the Orioles, how not bright it looks. The Orioles finished 28th out of the 30 teams that you of the 30 Major League Baseball teams in the rankings. And I think that's probably, for a lot of Orioles fans, that sounds about right, intuitively. But you guys tried to take more of a, you know, an objective approach to this. So can you just explain a little bit how you came up with the specific rankings?
The future power rankings are obviously a different kind of mission statement than a regular power rankings, which kind of focus on where a player is now. Several years ago, we talked about doing a future power rankings, which kind of focuses over the next 5 years. So it's not the unlimited future. There's still hope for the Orioles in like 2027. So there's a limit on my negativity there. Essentially, it's a blend of some projection data, some scouting data, Keith Law's scouting data. I use his farm system rankings as an input. There's obviously kind of a subjective element to it when you talk about front office performance, because there's not really a metric for that. And even if you say evaluated all the trades and signings, that's still not quite the whole purview of a front office. So there is a subjective element. I try to keep those to a minimum. And it's a blend of the 45%, I believe. 45% is the minor league ranking. 25% is the ranking of the current team talent. 20% comes to the financial support, simply because, yeah, teams with less money can compete, but they do have a smaller margin of error. And it is better to have more money than less money is what I've learned in life. No different in baseball. And then 10% is the front office ownership, almost a tiebreak category, because there's a lot of front office ownership in the previous categories. And it's just kind of the subjective stuff, which you do have to take into consideration. Like, how well does a team make a plan and stick to that plan? How focused is the team's how focused are the team's moves? There's a difference between, say, the White Sox and the rebuilding, where they've been really focused on it the last year, and say the Padres, who kind of do this awkward win now and then rebuild and then awkward win now again every few years. So hopefully the rankings are at least in the ballpark. I mean, there's only so much accuracy you can have when you do these kinds of things, but hopefully it creates a lot of conversations, which is what writing's about in the end.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, the 28th out of 30 for the Orioles, you know, I as a fan, I can't argue with that. I sort of have a pessimistic view on the way things are going at this point, and certainly the way that things are going to be after 2018. Not that I have high hopes for 2018, but after 2018, things look really grim for a while. So can you just explain, without getting into too much detail, why the Orioles rank so badly out of all the teams in Major League Baseball?
Well, when you look at the things, first you talk about the minor league system. And the minor league system's actually probably a little better than it was a few years ago, when you probably could have called them last or second to last. They're kind of in the 20s somewhere now, which, I mean, it's not great, but it's an improvement. problem you get into is that the front office and the ownership, it's not a very focused team. You look around baseball and you have teams that have pretty much latched on to the kind of the concept that you either have to win now or you have to win later. You can't awkwardly do neither and kind of just tread water. And you look at in the Orioles moves, you don't see a lot of focus there. Are they trying to win now? If they are, it's kind of odd the way they structure this team for probably the last season of Manny Machado in town. And Zach Britton's a free agent. Adam Jones is a free agent. And they didn't really address any of the team's weaknesses in any meaningful manner. And, of course, the biggest weakness is the rotation. And just picking up Andrew Cashner to replace Wade Miley and Ubaldo Jimenez and calling that a day, that's not really improvement. And you wanted to see that kind of thing if they were serious about competing. And if they weren't serious about competing in 2018, then none of the moves make sense either, because if you're entering a rebuild period, then hanging on to everything right now, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So the Orioles are kind of caught where they're neither winning now or winning later. And it's not a team that's going to have a payroll like the Yankees or the Dodgers. It's going to be a mid-tier payroll team at best. And you don't see a lot of front office unanimity. Dan Duquette, of course, is an old school GM at this point, but you can't see him seeing things eye to eye the same way that Buck Showalter does, or the same way Peter Angelis does. And you see teams right now, there's an increasing tendency to try to get front offices that will clash well or meld well. I guess clash well isn't a thing. Meld well with the managers. Like you look at the Cubs, the working relationship between Theo Epstein and Joe Maddon. You look at the entire Indians front office, how they work with Terry Francona. The Yankees, they didn't get rid of Joe Girardi because Joe Girardi was a bad manager, but they wanted someone who was more in line with Brian Cashman's philosophy, his temperament, and that's why you see Aaron Boone as the manager this year. But the Orioles, there's just a lot of problems, and you don't really see the focus or the motivation to solve them.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I always describe it, and I've probably used this phrase 15 times in this podcast already, is that they seem to be making it up as they go along. And that's the frustrating thing to me as an Orioles fan. Is, like you said, there never seems to be a plan. It's, we'll sign Mark Trumbo because Peter Angelos likes him. We'll bring Chris Tillman back because, what else are we going to do? There's never, like you said, there's never a full rebuild, and there's never a full commitment to winning, it seems like. And that gets very frustrating. I don't want you to play mind reader too much, but one of the things you always hear with the Orioles is who's actually making the decisions. How much authority does Dan Duquette actually have? How much of this is coming from Peter Angelos? How much of this is coming from the Angelos sons? What do you think is going on with the front office? Why does there seem to be such a lack of focus, like you said?
I think a lot of it is the ownership, because you look at the Orioles GMs. If you start around 1998, and you look at it today, there have been a lot of GMs, but the organization has pretty basically been run the same during that period, except for that brief period where Andy McPhail did have some authority and did try to rebuild the team. And that kind of made kind of like their most success came from that. When you look at like 2010, 2011, that at that point, people were saying that the team was just tanking. And that's when they had that 93 win season out of nowhere, because that 2012 team, they could do things that the Orioles normally didn't do. Taking a chance on Chris Davis, that wasn't something that the Orioles would generally do when you look at the run from like 1998 to 2010. There you saw a very kind of safe, no upside approach to things. Like the typical signing was like B.J. Surhoff or Jeff Conine. Now, nothing against them as players, and they did have their moments, but bringing in a 31-year-old B.J. Surhoff or aging Jeff Conine, that's not really an upside play. That's something you do when you're a contending team trying to take that final step. But the Orioles just always seem satisfied to try to put together a 500 team. And when that is your approach, where you're trying to get to 500, if that's the limit of your imagination, you're going to fall short of that, I think, in the end. And we're kind of back to that. The Orioles don't take a lot of interesting chances. It's just kind of, it feels like a bad 1983 front office.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, they signed Cashner, which doesn't really do much to, it doesn't really improve you from last year, but it, I guess, you know, it's a guy who people have heard of, at least in the rotation. That seems to be the motivating factor there in signing that. So again, I don't want you to have to play a role that you're not comfortable with. But if Dan Duquette's final season, and they bring in Brady Anderson, or they bring in somebody else in that role, is anything going to change, or are we just going to see more of the same? Because ultimately, the decisions are being made by an old man that we don't ever hear from anymore.
I don't think anything will change. I don't see. You look at front offices now, and they're people that have executive experience at this point. If you look at who runs front offices, there are very few ex-players or people without a long history of in organization of running things. You know, scouting director, assistant to the GM. I think that it's just gonna be the same old, same old. I think that it might be good for Duquette to get out. Maybe if he gets another job somewhere, he can kind of clean out some of the bad feeling about his role in everything, because he was a really solid GM with the Red Sox. So I can't say whether it was time moved on, but I do suspect that it was more than the front office. And I don't think you'll have any change until you have a drastic, change, a complete makeover of how the organization approaches problems and what it believes about the game. You can't be an organization in 2018 and not go after Shohei Ohtani, even if it's just a chance. The Cincinnati Reds had no chance at bringing in Ohtani. None. They didn't. But I know for a fact that front office put in a lot of work to still try. They tried their best. They did their due diligence. They did one of the best presentations. I've seen some of the materials. And when Ohtani eliminated them as a finalist, they begged them, essentially, to have another opportunity to present. Because even if it's not a perfect organization, that's what you need to do in 2018 when an opportunity like Ohtani comes through. And then you look at the Orioles and their insistence on not being involved in any kind of international signing. Now they talk about it as if it's a philosophical thing that he doesn't like exploiting players. But one, I mean, that's also the game. If you're not going to go after young international talent, you have to have more talent elsewhere, but they're not having that either. And when you come down to it, the whole philosophical objection seems a little insincere, because the Orioles don't mind exploiting minor leaguers with the pay. I don't see them giving, you know, $100,000 a year wages to a typical minor leaguer. I don't see them not paying, say, Manny Machado near the minimum before he hits arbitration. So that philosophical stance seems a little inconsistent with itself from the start. But you have to make over how the team approaches baseball, period. And that is a big challenge.
Right, and that's the challenge that, say, the Cubs took on when they hired Theo Epstein. You know, it's the challenge the Astros took on when they decided they were just going to suck for a couple of years. And that's the decision the Orioles haven't made. They just haven't taken that next step of just completely tanking. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to take the Angelos family selling the team, if it's going to take Peter Angelos, shall we say, leaving this mortal coil. But he is not a young man, we'll put you that way. But, yeah, it does seem like they're sort of stuck in this position they've been in for 20 years where nobody in the ownership group has got with the times and has decided that they're going to do things the way other teams do it in 2018, and more's the pity. All right, well, give us some reason to be optimistic. You mentioned the farm system's looking a little bit better than it did a couple of years ago. If you're an Orioles fan in 2018, and say my son's 14, give him a reason to think when he's in college the Orioles might be good.
Okay, well, I don't want to say Angelos is old. That's a little gauche, but there's some interesting pitching. I mean, Kevin Gausman still has upside. Dylan Bundy still has upside, and not so much in 2018. But there's a path where Hunter Harvey and Tanner Scott become legitimate contributors. Tanner Scott, especially, is extremely interesting. When I run the projections for Scott long term, you don't get like a pretty little curve. You get kind of a bimodal projection where he either succeeds amazingly or fails spectacularly given his profile. And sometimes he'll fail spectacularly, but a lot of those times there's a chance that he might be a star, and that's the kind of thing that's exciting. But again, you would need, when the Orioles have successes, can they build a team around that? And that's the big question. But the good news is that the future is a long time. I think if you asked Astros fans in 2018 where the team would be in a decade, or Cubs fans in 2007 where the team would be in a decade, I don't think they'd be as optimistic as what happened. So there's always hope. He could sell the team. He could so-called find religion and become a modern franchise. You never really know about the future. So there's still hope, even if it doesn't look good right now.
So you mentioned, you know, Tanner Scott could be very successful or he could fail spectacularly. And you hear that as an Orioles fan, with a pitcher, and your first thought is, it's a pitcher in the Orioles system. Of course he's going to fail spectacularly. That's what Orioles pitchers do. I guess beyond just the things we've already talked about, the lack of organizational focus, the lack of running a modern ball club the way it should be run, do you think there's a reason that Orioles pitching prospects seem to fail so often, particularly with the Orioles or in starting pitcher roles? For instance, you know, we know Arrieta went on to a different team and succeeded. We know Zach Britton was successful in a role other than starter. But for the most part, the Orioles, you know, the pitchers they've had who've looked like they're going to be good or had, you know, were top prospects or high draft picks have not turned into successful major league pitchers. Is there a reason for that beyond just general organizational incompetence?
It's hard to say. There's obviously a chance aspect to it. There's a lot of luck involved in developing a pitcher. It does seem to me that the Orioles tend to try to want to develop their pitchers in more of a cookie cutter way rather than play to their strengths. I think back at Daniel Cabrera, and of course, Daniel Cabrera was a lot like Tanner Scott. He could throw in the upper 90s and have no idea where it was going. But instead of accepting that that's kind of what he was and they had to work with that, the Orioles wanted him to dial back the fastball a little just in the hopes it would get his control better. But his fastball was his strength as a pitcher. So once he backed off a little, instead of having a 98-mile-per-hour fastball, having no idea what he was going, where it was going, he was a much easier-to-hit pitcher that had no idea where the ball was going. I mean, his first two full years in the majors, he was around eight. He allowed about eight hits per nine innings. After he kind of dialed that back, he was easier to hit, struck out fewer guys. The walk rate barely improved, and then he got injured, and now it's kind of the end of it. I think that you have to develop a Jake Arrieta different than you develop, say, a Kevin Gausman or a Hunter Harvey. All these guys, you want to develop them differently. You look at the Cubs, they let Kyle Hendricks be Kyle Hendricks. They didn't try to turn Kyle Hendricks into a traditional power pitcher. That wasn't going to happen. They didn't try to turn Jake Arrieta into a nibbler. They let him throw that heavy sinkery thing that he has. I think that kind of approach where you is almost an Earl Weaver thing, because one of Earl Weaver's beliefs was that you had to accept a player based on what they were and work on that. You couldn't have, you know, preconceived roles of a player that you try to fit in. If a guy can't hit lefties, then you put him in a position where he doesn't have to hit lefties. You don't bemoan the fact that he can't. You focus on a player's strength and obsess about their weaknesses. So I would like to see the Orioles just be more flexible in general with their team.
Well, boy, yeah, you know, I can't agree with you more than on that last thing, because I'm actually old enough to remember Earl Weaver, the last 5-6 years of when he was the Orioles manager the first time around, and yeah, you're absolutely right. He was a guy who would pick players off the scrap heap and make them succeed by putting them into platoon roles or putting them into specialty roles out of the bullpen or whatever it was. And so many guys came in who had been, you know, John Lowenstein and Jim Dwyer and Steve Stone and all these guys who had failed in other organizations or been, you know, kind of meh in other organizations came in and succeeded with the Orioles for that very reason. And I really wish they could get back to that philosophy, that's for sure.
What I think about with the Orioles, and I think about some of those guys like tonight, let it be Lowenstein. I think of Hyun-Soo Kim, who was a good signing, a good risk to take. When he didn't play well in the spring, they started panicking, and then that already poisoned the relationship with the player. And of course, he had a 380 on base percentage in 2016, but the team still couldn't figure out what to do with him. It was almost like he was an annoyance to them in a way. And so he got very sparing playing time in 2017 and was never really given a chance to succeed full time in a role. And you look at Kim and say, okay, you don't necessarily want him to fit against a lot of lefties. He's not a good defensive player. And Earl Weaver would have focused on what he could do rather than what he couldn't. The Orioles never saw past the things that Kim couldn't do.
Yeah, very, very true. Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining us. I wish it had been a happier topic, but we got to be realistic about where this team is. And I think you're nothing if not realistic when you assess teams. So I appreciate it. And thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
And that's going to do it for another edition of Locked On Orioles. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.